The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Only considering those processes related to electoral disqualifications, there are no major consequences than this one that halts him from disputing elections in the next 8 years. But we have another criminal lawsuits that involve several other things, let's say, the way by which Bolsonaro managed the COVID-19 pandemic and so on, that can go on in lower courts now in Brazil and probably bring some results that are harsher for Bolsonaro. I don't know if prison would be one of them, but at least in an abstract way, we could consider that this is something that probably Bolsonaro is, let's say, afraid of.
I'm Tyler McBrien, Managing Editor of Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 27th, 2023. Last month, Brazil's highest electoral court found that former President Jair Bolsonaro had abused his political power in the 2022 elections because of his conduct in a meeting with foreign ambassadors in Brasilia in July 2022. For this violation of the country's election laws, the electoral court banned Bolsonaro from seeking public office until 2030. To talk about Bolsonaro's disqualification, I sat down with Emilio Peluso Niedermayer, professor of constitutional law at the Federal University of Minas Gerais, and Thomas Bustamante, professor of legal theory at the same university, to discuss Brazil's search for accountability and justice in the aftermath of the coup attempt on January 8th. We also talked about why the electoral court's ruling was not so much a legal innovation as a mere application of existing laws, the significance of President Lula's decision not to rely on the military in his government's response, and what's next for Bolsonarismo. It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 27th, Brazil's search for accountability after January 8th. So, Emilio and Thomas, most of our listeners will be quite familiar with the events of January 8th, 2023 in Brasilia, not to be confused with January 6th, which was perhaps a similar event, perhaps different in many ways in the United States. But for those who are not as familiar, can you just walk us through what happened that day in Brazil and perhaps some of the lead up as well? And Emilio, I'll start with you.
So, what happened that day on the 8th of January 2023 was a kind of an attempt, or let's say an idea that some of protesters that were manifesting to support Bolsonaro after the elections of 2022 found that a good way to start a kind of institutional rupture or a coup d'etat would be to destroy some of the most important buildings of the constituted powers here in Brazil, that, in other words, the Federal Supreme Court, the National Congress, and also the presidency. And then in that case, what happened was that we were in Brazil in a kind of a polarization for more than 6 years, at least. We could say this was the period of time. And some of the supporters of Bolsonaro found that it was important to also took most violent actions against the results of the 2022 elections. We must remind that in 2022, now President Lula was running for this position against Bolsonaro, who was our former president at that time for the 2018-2022 term. And then those supporters, some of them they think that a military intervention or something like that could be important to secure that Bolsonaro could stay in power. So what they do in the 8th January 2023 was to go to Brasilia. There were some rumors that those protests would be violent, but some of the security authorities found that this would not happen. And some of them knew that this could happen, but they left the protesters to go ahead. They just keep on watching what was going on. And then what we could see was the destruction of several of these buildings, three of them, actually, the most important of them. And this kind of showcase that if there was something that Bolsonaro could do, actually, the military could do after Bolsonaro left power. We must remember that Lula started his term on the 1st January. So if the military authorities could do something like, let's say, try to do a coup d'etat, there were protesters supporting them in the streets and making that the armed forces could do something and, let's say, create a kind of artificial government for that time and ignore the results of the 2022 elections, which was something that still now we don't have a clear idea that the armed forces could support this kind of initiative, but this was the scenario that those protesters were seeing.
I would like to add just that there was an expectation of a coup. Some of the Bolsonaro supporters, they were claiming for a coup. And in the subworld of social medias and the internet, WhatsApp, Telegram, all these forms of communication, there was a call for a coup. And there was even an attempt to justify in legal terms, although, of course, the legal basis for that was very fragile. But there were people arguing that the military, they have a constitutional power to protect the legal order, protect the state when requested by any of the branches. Okay, so they think that, or they argued at least, that the military could exercise some sort of moderating branch, like a branch beyond the branches, to take control of the government in order to repeal some threats. So there was this idea that if chaos installed itself in Brasilia in the three branches square, which is the square in Brasilia is where the headquarters of the federal government, the legislature, and the Supreme Court, they are all placed in a single branch. So if they took over that, there was an expectation that the government itself would ask the militaries to intervene in order to bring back the peace. And if the government made that request, there were people who were thinking that they could make the intervention more robust in order to take control of the government itself. So that was the expectation, I think. Many people believed that if they seized the government and the government itself asked for military to intervene in order to bring back peace, that could be a justification. That could be a legal justification for the military to take control of the government in broader terms than requested by the government itself.
Now, thank you for setting that up. And before we move on to the aftermath and the response by Lula and the federal government, including the significance of not actually calling on the military, Tomas, can you just give us a sense of just how much chaos there was? What was the scale of this attempted coup or riot? How many people were involved? And what was the sort of scale of the destruction?
Part of the Supreme Court was complete. The plenary setting, the building where they reunite themselves, was completely destroyed. And there was a lot of damage also in the Senate, in the Chamber of Deputies, in the presidency. I think two or three floors of the building were completely destroyed. But nobody was hurt physically. So that's the difference between what happened in the U.S. where people died. Nothing like that happened. But there was a lot of destruction. About 2,000 people were arrested the following day. Okay, so when the government intervened in the federal government intervened in the government of the federal district, so they took control of the police, and the police responded to the person nominated by the federal government to temporarily take control of the forces of the state. And when that happened, so the military did not react, did not respond. So there was the sense of the legal order was reestablished. And following the attack, many people were arrested on site in the day after the attack, because they were all camped in front of the headquarters of the armies. So many people were arrested, and now, as we speak, there are more than 1,000 people being facing criminal prosecution for their different forms of participation in the event.
Yeah, and Emilio, let's stay on this immediate response. Thomas kind of began to speak about the immediate response from Lula. If you could take us back to the night of January 8th, maybe. What challenge was facing Lula and the federal government in terms of restoring order? What were some of the trade-offs, do you think, that the government weighed in designing a response, especially at the executive level, to the events that had just unfolded?
Yeah, I think that the protesters were hoping that President Lula would do something that Thomas was just mentioning, that was to use a very disputable interpretation of Article 142 of the Constitution that states that the armed forces, if they are provoked by the president, they have a role in protecting the institutional order. So the protesters were hoping that Lula would follow that way. And I think that Lula was very smart politically to think about another way out. And he did it. I think that some of these decisions, they are part of what his Minister of Justice, Flavio Dino, what he thinks about the best way to deal with this kind of crisis. And then what he did was to use the Constitution, Article 34 of the Constitution, which establishes, like Thomas said, what we call here in Brazil a federal intervention. So it was a measure that was provided by the Constitution. It wasn't nothing like a state of exception or something like that. He just used a remedy that the 1988 Constitution offers, and then he interfered in the government that is responsible to manage the city or the capital of Brasília. And then that was a very glad response, I think, because he avoided to use the military. Instead, what he did was to fire the commander of the army, because there was this discussion that the army was kind of creating some kind of support for the protesters because of those people who were campaigning in the headquarters of the army. There are some rumors that even families of military were there. And then what happened then the following day, because of all of this discussion that took place, and there is also the idea that the Minister of Justice argued with the commander of the army on what to do on that very day. And I think that one thing that was important was to not have anyone arrested in that very day. So the imprisonments started in the following day, in the following morning, and then things were a little bit better, or in a better scenario. But as Thomas just mentioned, we had something like 2,000 people arrested, and now 1,000 people are facing criminal lawsuits that will be ruled by the Federal Supreme Court.
I think that there was a combination of factors that perhaps saved the Brazilian democracy or prevented further consequences. The government response was very moderate, but was enough to gain some control of the police. The police forces responded to the interventor that was nominated by the federal government. But there was also some judicial response, which was very effective too. Justice Alexandre de Moraes, he gave a restraining order that was that had a much broader scope than the federal intervention. He removed from office the governor, the recently elected governor of the federal district, and the head of security, the secretary of security of the federal district. He was imprisoned. He was because of that, because of his negligence. He was the secretary of security in the district, in the federal district, was Bolsonaro's former Ministry of Justice. And during his term, he consistently acted to allow this kind of thing, to allow the people to protest in front of the headquarters of the army to ask for a coup. And also there was a very serious problem during the election itself in the Rodoviary, in the Rodoviary police, traffic police, that kind of blocked, that put some roadblocks in the districts where Lula has majority in the Northeast to prevent voters to travel to vote. So many buses were stopped, you know, and there was this huge scale operation to prevent people from voting in some of the zones where Lula has a vast majority. And the head of the, at that time, there was this joint effort of the Ministry of Justice and the chief of the traffic police to do that. So there was this this constant support for this kind of interference.
Yeah, maybe something that we should also mention is that there is this broader scenario that was constructed, built by Bolsonaro from 2018 on. So he started his term saying that the electronic ballots in Brazil, they were frauded, that actually he was able to win the elections from in the first round in 2018, and then something could happen again in 2022 if he could lose the elections. And then as he lost the elections, those people organized themselves, and some of them were in a certain sense motivated by Bolsonaro's discourse that they should protest against the results of the elections. And then this kind of mood was was growing throughout the end of 2022 and the start of 2023. One of the things that is important to consider is that this former Minister of Justice and then now former Secretary of Public Security in the Federal District, he was at the U.S. at the time of the 8th of January, a kind of, I don't know if it was holidays or something like that, but the federal police was able to find in his house a plan to declare a kind of a state of exception that would affect the Superior Electoral Court, which is the authority here in Brazil to oversee the elections. So it is something that has some motivations that are we can think that we can credit to the protesters themselves, but we know that there are several things that indicate that Bolsonaro and his supporters, they were trying to create this kind of idea to fight the results of the 2022 elections.
That document was called by the media the coup draft, because yeah. It was a presidential decree. It was a draft. It was not signed. It was just a draft, like something that we do at home to submit to the president before it happens. But it was a draft of a presidential decree that was not used, but shows at least that it was considered, a formal coup was considered, was under the radar.
Yeah. And so, I mean, in speaking about this so-called coup draft or coup rough draft or something like that, I know you've both written that it was actually submitted as a piece of evidence in the electoral disqualification trial. So I think this might be actually a good time to set that up. So I think that the big headlines, at least that made it to the US, were, you know, on January 8th in the months, and then almost 6 months after Bolsonaro's eventual disqualification. So can you walk us through, you know, the origins of the trial itself, and then we can now talk about after that, the consequences of a Bolsonaro disqualification. Amelia, I'll go back to you.
So what happens is that in July 2022, Bolsonaro, made a meeting with several foreign ambassadors in Brasilia, with the aim to show them that there were serious suspicions against the electoral process, that the electronic vote in Brazil was frauded, and that they must pay attention to what was happening in Brazil, because something could happen in the 2022 elections that was not the result of what voters in Brazil were trying to do or to elect to choose as the president for the results of the 2022 elections. So he made that meeting, and right after that, political party here in Brazil started a representation, a lawsuit at the Superior Electoral Court to discuss the disqualification of Bolsonaro for future elections because of this meeting. What was the main argument there? We have in Brazil, this is stated in the 1988 Constitution, that elections shall be protected against candidates that try to abuse their political power, their economic power, in order to interfere with the results of the elections. So to create situations in which we can find that some of those candidates, they have more chances to win an election because of this political power, because of this economic power. So the argument was that he made this meeting. He used the state TV broadcast to try to create this scenario of suspicion against the electronic ballot without any kind of real evidence or concrete evidence. These lawsuits started, and it has a previous investigation that went through the end of 2022 and then came to 2023. When Bolsonaro was tried by those with supporting this kind of disqualification, and then the Electoral Superior Court decided that Bolsonaro should be disqualified for future eight years on future elections in Brazil, because he abused his power to, without any kind of concrete evidence, make those kind of public manifestations or public discourse against the security of electronic ballot here in Brazil. So, as we mentioned in this internet in this blog post, this is something that was nothing new for the case law of the Electoral Superior Court. Actually, the Electoral Superior Court has in the past ruled that any kind of fake news or any kind of suspicious discourse against electronic ballot, if it doesn't have any kind of concrete evidence, can lead to disqualification of someone to be in a public position or an electoral position.
Thomas, I'd like to turn to you. What was Bolsonaro's defense? We know now that it was ultimately unsuccessful. On what constitutional or other legal grounds did Bolsonaro, you know, mount a defense?
The most persistent defense that he presents to the public, not necessarily to the court, was that it was an interference in his freedom of speech, and that the judiciary itself has become a censor. Furthermore, there was a more technical defense presented by his lawyers, that Bolsonaro was being tried by a much broader accusation than the one that was presented. For instance, when they attached the draft coup to the case files, Bolsonaro was saying that he did not have a chance to defend himself and that he was being accused of some conducts that fall beyond the strict competence of the electoral courts, because the superior electoral court can only adjudicate on matters relating to the elections itself. So there was a defense. There was a technical argument that Bolsonaro was being tried by a broader accusation than the electoral illegalities that were argued in the first place. This was not the only electoral complaint against Bolsonaro. There were 15 other cases brought against Bolsonaro, and some of them related to much more serious accusations, like the one that I already talked about, that they prevented voters from getting to the voting places with roadblocks. And there was another accusation that Bolsonaro used a lot of the resources in the federal budget to give in the last minute sums of money in terms of social benefits to voters in order to interfere in the elections. The electoral protection system in Brazil is like the antitrust laws. Okay, that's a nice metaphor. So there are norms to protect the fairness of the competition. So if somebody uses the resources of the government to intervene on the elections, we call that abuse of political power. And if someone uses in an illegal way economic resources, we call that abuse of economic power. And both of them are grounds for disqualification from electoral competitions.
So what's the status of those other sometimes more serious investigations or cases against Bolsonaro? And could we see even harsher consequences for the former president? Emilio, I can go back to you.
Yeah, one thing that we shall bear in mind is that those procedures in the electoral justice here in Brazil, they have a timeline that is fast than the ones that we compare in the rest of our courts here in Brazil. So I think that we will see another rulings in the next, let's say, 6 months or even a year. So I think that probably Bolsonaro will be condemned in several other of those 15 lawsuits that Thomas was just mentioning. But what happens is that being condemned in one lawsuit that applies to him this term of 8 years to be disqualified from elections, it won't be the case that we can see another condemnation that will sum with these previous ones. So he would not be set aside from running for political positions for let's say eternity. So we probably will see him trying to run for an electoral position in the future, but after those 8 years that were part of the condemnation that took place right now. So there are no, at least as I see these processes, and only considering those processes related to electoral disqualifications, there are no major consequences than this one that halts him from disputing elections in the next 8 years. But we have another criminal lawsuits that involve several other things, let's say, the way by which Bolsonaro managed the COVID-19 pandemic and so on, that can go on in lower courts now in Brazil and probably bring some results that are harsher for Bolsonaro. I don't know if prison would be one of them, but at least in an abstract way, we could consider that this is something that probably Bolsonaro is, let's say, afraid of.
There are corruption accusations against Bolsonaro. There is accusation about the mismanagement of the pandemic. But these are all criminal cases that will not be adjudicated by an electoral court. As Emilio said, Bolsonaro already got all the punishment that he could get from an electoral court. The convictions are not summed up. So if he gets convicted in all of the 15 cases remaining, that will not alter his punishment. It will be 8 years, and that's the maximum punishment in the law.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20
and use promo code LAWFARE20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
Now, as one of you mentioned, it's likely that if Bolsonaro is healthy and capable, he will perhaps attempt to run in 8 years for political office again. But in the intervening time, over the next 8 years, just how bad is this for Bolsonaro? In other words, you know, has he been completely cast out from political life for the next 8 years? Is he irrelevant? Or, you know, does he have other ways to influence Brazilian politics, marshal his supporters in other ways? Just how severe of a penalty really is this for Bolsonaro?
Well, I think that that's a political judgment hard to make before the election itself. But Bolsonaro remains a very strong political voice in Brazil. And he will have, and there's a dispute in the far right about who is going to succeed him. There are people who want his wife to run for president or at least for senator. She's a very strong political voice, even though she is sometimes perceived as even more radical than Bolsonaro himself. She is a very militant, very active religious militant, a Christian fundamentalist. And there are some people in the market that voted for Bolsonaro that might resist her. And there are other guys like the governor of the state of Minas Gerais, Zema, who is now turning more to the far right in order to get like the inheritance from Bolsonaro. And so he's still a very powerful political voice. His party is the largest party in Brazil, with about 100 seats in the Chamber of Deputies, the House of Representatives. So he is a very strong political player. And I think that his support might fade a little bit if Lula is successful in achieve his economic goals, if his economic policies grow strong. I think that the people who are not the 30% that inevitably will vote in Bolsonaro, but the other guys, the 20% more that made him president in 2018, these people might switch sides. And there are people in the center already thinking about switching to the side of Lula because of the successful so far conduction of the economy in the first 6 months of his term.
I think that the future of Bolsonaro as a political actor is linked to, let's say, a kind of political concept that was developed here in Brazil, which is something that have some similar veins of with what happens in the U.S., which would be a political movement of Bolsonarism, in the sense, or something like Trumpism for Brazilian people. So Thomas wrote about it in the past. I wrote about it in the past. This political movement, although it has a shape, it has a form, it's not particularly or clearly substantially defined. So there are several people that vote for Bolsonaro and that supported Bolsonaro in the second round of the elections of 2022, even though Bolsonaro is a very bad figure and so on, but that opted for Bolsonaro because they saw that Lula was the opposite candidate. So I think that the number between 20%, 30% of the population in Brazil has some sympathy or has some links with Bolsonaro and the movement as a whole. But there are other people who vote for Bolsonaro but are not actually his supported. And I think that the problem for him now is much more to deal with what would be the good results of Lula's administration. And I think that the scenario, at least now, at least if we are thinking in the present moment, are not good for Bolsonaro, because Lula is succeeding in some economic achievements that Bolsonaro wasn't able to do in the past. And this could lead to even this party that now is his party, which is not actually his party, because it's a kind of a center party that tries to dialogue with the far right and at the same time sometimes support some of Lula's initiatives right now. It is part of what we call here in Brazil Centrão, or the big center, the large center of politics in Brazil, which is something like that keeps on changing depending on who is the president at the time. So I think that Bolsonaro doesn't have a very strong or secure support as Lula had in the past. If we think and we analyze what is the Workers' Party and the substance of the Workers' Party and what voters and supporters of the Workers' Party do independently of who is the president, it is a very different scenario than the one that Bolsonaro is living now. I think that Bolsonaro would depend much more on financial initiatives that could help him guarantee that in the future he would be someone that can be important for the members of his political party, the Liberal Party.
Yeah, I want to make sure that we address an interesting point that you both brought up in one of your articles that was made by a Brazilian political scientist, I believe, Fernando Lamongi, who said in one of Brazil's biggest newspapers that, you know, he made the argument that perhaps it would be better if Bolsonaro was defeated in elections rather than disqualified by courts. Emilio, as you were actually, you know, answering the last question, it occurred to me that maybe if the movement is bigger than the man, then Bolsonarism in, you know, the coming years, you know, might be defeated in elections, even if Bolsonaro himself isn't standing for elections. But Thomas, I want to give you a chance to address that point, because it was quite an interesting one, I think, toward the end.
No, I think that Limongi nor ordinarily have a point. I mean, it's better to defeat politics in elections than in courts. But I think that there is another point, is that a counterpoint that could be made against this claim is that politics has to have at least some sort of attachment to the rule of law. We have been facing since 2013 many challenges to the rule of law, in which people lost sense of the idea that we do politics because we do not want to do war. There must be some sort of political morality that must be protected, and we lost that. First, in Dilma Rousseff's impeachment in 2016, which was an impeachment without any impeachable offense. And it's very, very clear that there was no impeachable offense, but they did it anyway just because they could. And we lost that in the ordinary politics. So Bolsonaro attacked the courts, and he used his attacks on the legal systems as a political strategy of survival. So I think that there must be some sort of line that cannot be crossed. Because when you cross that line, like he did in the handling of the COVID pandemic, people die. People die because of some political rhetorics. And other illegalities are committed. Just a couple of weeks before January 8th, there was a guy, a Bolsonaro supporter, who was a former policeman, I think, that just put a bomb in Brasilia's airport. And the government was encouraging that. He was arming the population. He was invoking like the rhetoric that we have in the U.S. About the rights to bear arms. So in order to invite the people to arm themselves and go to the streets to defend Bolsonaro. So I think that there are things that you cannot do while you run for an election. Perhaps Bolsonaro should have been disqualified, not because of the case that was trialed, but because of the other one that's still pending judgment about the use of resources in the budget to buy votes in a disguised way, or the other case that put roadblocks to prevent voters to get in the election sites, because these are much more serious electoral offenses. But I do not think that this is just an unqualified point, that the only way to prevent somebody from running from office is through electoral defeat, because this was a very dirty election. Bolsonaro intervened in the elections in several ways, many more than we can account for. So he was adopting the kind of illiberal strategy to compromise the electoral process by changing the electoral rules in order to remain in power. So we must defend the electoral system. And I do not think that in this particular case, the Superior Electoral Court went beyond its powers to disqualify Bolsonaro.
One of the things that we can observe in this ruling from the Electoral Superior Court is that there is a role that the Electoral Superior Courts or the electoral courts, they play in Brazilian democracy, which is truly important for the rule of law. And it's nothing that it is new for Brazilian democracy. So Bolsonaro tried to create this discourse that the Electoral Superior Court was interfering with the elections in a bad way and so on. But I think that probably the argument that one can argue in the sense that, okay, it would be better if Bolsonaro could be defeated through elections is a fragile argument, because it does not pay attention to the role that the rule of law shall play in elections in Brazil. We have a basis for it in the 1988 Constitution. We have a basis for it in several different statutory legislation here in Brazil. So the Electoral Superior Court gave Bolsonaro several advices in the sense that he would be punished because of his rhetoric against the electronic ballots here in Brazil. So I think that what the Electoral Superior Court did was something that the court should do actually to protect democracy through the use of rule of law, which is something that is truly important. We don't have a clear separation between rule of law and democracy in the sense that we can use any of them separately.
Yeah, I think one line from one of your articles captures this well, where you wrote, "The ruling is not a legal innovation, but the mere application of existing laws." I want to just, you know, put on the table here and ask, in both of your, you know, expert legal opinions, was there any aspect of the federal government's response or Lula's response that was perhaps extra legal or existing in a legal gray area? Or Thomas, I can turn to you, that, you know, would you call this, you know, very, you know, by the book response?
I think that the federal government's response was much more by the book than the federal Supreme Court's response, because it was very moderate, very timid, very in point, very temporary. So it was very, very clear. So the Supreme Court has a much more robust response. Of course, it was provoked by some claims that were adduced, but in order to remove content from the internet in order to authorize some temporary arrests, I mean, which were more intrusive than the federal government's response. So I don't think that there's an issue about the federal government's response. So I think that it was a moderate response, and I think that it was effective, and it was the right response. It was wisely responded. There are some concerns about some cases in the Federal Supreme Court. There is an inquiry, which they call it the fake news inquiry, in which the Justice Alexandre de Moraes is making many injunctions, temporary injunctions, like arrests or investigations that may here or there be punctual violations, but overall, I don't think that it was a bad response.
Yeah, well, one thing that probably the audience must be aware of is that we were talking about here how the Electoral Superior Court ruled in the case of Bolsonaro and disqualified him, but there is the other role played by the Federal Supreme Court, which is another court here in Brazil, and then the Federal Supreme Court, which was also the subject of several criticisms directed by Bolsonaro's supporters and even by himself, has some inquiries that are related to the protection of democracy. The thing that is debatable on those inquiries, as Thomas was just mentioning, is that there is a prominent role that has been played by one single justice, who is Alexandre de Moraes, which were linked to several important rulings that were, yes, important to defend the Brazilian democracy, as in the case of, let's say, the suspension of the public security secretary of the federal district right after the 8th January. But there are other rulings that cause a kind of a bad impression. So you have several rulings being taken by the same justice, using and expanding his competence, his jurisdiction, in a sense that is dangerous, to say the minimum. And after the 8th January, we must bear in mind that the Federal Supreme Court started four new inquiries to identify who were the responsible for financing, for going and destroying the buildings on the 8th of January. There are several crimes to which those accused ones must respond now. And then this discussion is a discussion that is taking place right here now in Brazil. What is the role of the Supreme Court? Can the Supreme Court go so far in protecting democracy in Brazil? Or there are limits that the Federal Supreme Court should pay attention in order to protect the very rule of law?
I don't have to remind both of you that Brazil is a very large and diverse country, but I want to give the listeners a sense of the response from the public. I think in the days after January 8th, you saw thousands of counter-protesters take to the streets in Sao Paulo and elsewhere denouncing this attempted coup or riot. You know, in the days after the announcement of Bolsonaro's electoral disqualification, for example, what has the response been from the public? Or on the flip side, in terms of Bolsonaro supporters, what has the lack of response been? I think maybe you haven't seen perhaps demonstrations that some would expect to see after such a blow to a leader as Bolsonaro. So Thomas, can you give the listeners a sense of sort of public opinion and public action in these past 6 months since January 8th?
Yeah, I think that after, while Bolsonaro was in power, his ability to regiment people to go to the street and defend him was much greater than it is now. So when Bolsonaro lost the election, just before handing over the power to Lula, he went to the United States and spent 2 months there. So some of his electors felt like abandoned by him. Not everyone, of course, but the people who, especially those who were expecting the coup to happen, saw like a negligence, saw like an inertia. And it might be one of the explanations of why, after Bolsonaro was disqualified, not so many people were in the streets trying to defend him. There was not a single big act with or big demonstration or rally with thousands of people in the streets to defend Bolsonaro. It was as if as his disqualification was not a surprise, even to himself. He put some posts in the internet, and some of his supporters, some of the representatives from his party made speeches, but that was all that there was to it. So in a sense, his capacity to put people in the streets defending him was smaller than we could anticipate. That does not mean, of course, that Bolsonarism is dead. There is a lot of people who still defend him, but they are more silent now. You can see them because if you walk in the streets, you will see some houses with a Brazilian flag at the front door. If there is a Brazilian flag in the front door, you know that there is a Bolsonaro supporter living there. And right now, as where I am, if I just go out of my house, I will see three of them, and the people are still there, but they are quieter now. And I think that this is a good thing, because that's what's supposed to happen when you lose.
Well, Bolsonaro was very active in the past 4 years, trying to create political situations that could give him support from his most far-right supporters or strengthen his support. Every day there was something new. Even during the pandemic, he was trying to create some political case, something that could make him being in the newspapers or in social media, or in people trying to share his tweets and so on throughout 2018-2022. Right after he lost the elections, there were rumors that he became depressed, so he did not talk to the press from the day of the result until he went to the U.S. He abandoned actually his position as a president. There is also a discussion if he could do it as a president, leaving the post right before his mandate, his term was ended. And I think that this whole situation gave his supporters a scenario in which they saw we don't have actually a strong leader. And this is something that most of his supporters, as far-righter supporters or conservative supporters, want to have a strong leader to which they could refer to. And I think that this is something that made them orphans of what would be the one people that would guide Bolsonarism throughout the next years in the opposition to Lula's government.
And as we near the end here, I would love to hear from each of you what you're keeping an eye on as the response in the aftermath of January 8th continues to unfold, whether it's these criminal prosecutions that are making their way through the courts, other legal challenges, legal and otherwise challenges that Bolsonaro is facing. What are you paying attention to in these next few months to a year? Thomas, we can start with you.
Yeah, I'm glad that I've started because Emilio has an expertise in the topic, so he will be able to respond to some of the challenges that I will raise now. I think that the toughest challenge of the Brazilian democracy is to reach the military who cooperated with Bolsonaro. And they think that they are beyond the reach of the rule of law. So they were generals, they were colonels and people in a very high military posts that actively embraced Bolsonaro's coupist rhetoric. There were people who were working with him in his cabinet, and there is an investigation that shows that some of the military who are in charge of protecting the presidency, the institution of the presidency, they were actually conspiring or trying to create chaos, okay? So I think that there, we sometimes live again something that we lived when Brazil, of course, perhaps in a smaller scale, but we lived the same problem, which is the accountability of the military who took part in this, okay? I don't know. I don't think that it was the majority, but there were militaries, especially in high ranks, that clearly endorsed Bolsonaro. And some of his speeches and some of his acts and perhaps did not respond because they hoped that the coupist would succeed. So I think that this should be investigated and these people should be held accountable to the rule of law. That was one of the biggest problems in Brazil after the redemocratization of 1988. Not a single torturer or a person who committed crimes being part of the military government has been punished for their deeds. If you compare Brazil and Argentina, all of the main participants in the military regime that endorsed torture, they were punished. Nothing like that ever happened in Brazil. And I think that it seems like the military will be out of the reach of the law again. So the toughest challenge is to tell them that they are also subject to the law and they respond to their deeds. So if there is a proof of participation of generals and people from the military in these attacks, these individuals should be held accountable to the law. And if they are not, this might have serious consequences for the future.
Yeah, I think that we shall now pay attention not only to what the Superior Electoral Court would do with Bolsonaro in the other 15 lawsuits, but also what the Federal Supreme Court will do with the more than 1,000 people that were subject to criminal lawsuits because of the 8th of January. But I'm not optimist in relation to any changes that can take place between civil authorities here in Brazil and military authorities. Until now, everything that is related to the accountability of military agents for the 8th of January is being discussed as something that should be treated internally. So the armed forces would go on with their administrative procedures, and if there is an accountability, the armed forces will take care of this. And this is something that, unfortunately, President Lula still keeps with a kind of conciliation discourse, in the sense that, okay, if there is something, let's try to find the people who can be held accountable, but let's not go that far to create problems between the armed forces and his government. So he nominated someone to be the Minister of Defense, which is the someone responsible for the three armed forces. And this is someone which is very in this idea that we must create some kind of a political conciliation with the military. We must not be so strong in trying to set them accountable for those violations. So I think that we have some things that will not change, at least for now, and won't change for the next, let's say, years. And unfortunately for Brazil, it's a thing that it's a thing that we should treat in a different way that we treated in the past 30 years or 40 years of after the 1988 Constitution.
Well, just as in the United States with January 6th, I think the search for accountability and justice continues. Emilio and Thomas Obrigado, thank you so much for taking the time to join me and speak to me today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure, Tyler.
Thank you, Tyler. It was a pleasure.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and of the Lawfare Podcast by becoming a Lawfare material supporter through our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for other shows, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfaremedia.org. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Jay Venables of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.